From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, Blood, an epic history of medicine and commerce. We talk with science journalist Douglas Starr. His book is the basis of the new PBS series on the story of blood. We'll hear about some of the early beliefs surrounding blood, why doctors used to bleed their patients, and what was the outcome of the first known blood transfusion, which transferred the blood of a calf to the body of a mentally ill man. Also, TV critic David Bianculli invites us to forego summer reruns on TV for reruns on DVD. He'll tell us about some of the new DVD collections. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. After taking testimony in a closed hearing today from CIA Director George Tenet and FBI Director Robert Mueller, Senate Intelligence Committee Chairman Bob Graham said the plot leading to the attacks on September 11th was hatched 3 years earlier by al-Qaeda. NPR's David Wellner reports from the Capitol.
Intelligence Chair Graham said the first full day of testimony from the FBI and CIA directors before a joint House and Senate Intelligence Committee centered on the plot that led to the September 11th attacks. The al-Qaeda plot, he indicated, can be traced back to the year 1998.
I would say shortly after the African embassy bombings. One of the things about al-Qaeda is it tends to be a repetitive organization, and generally they take about 3 years between the time they identify a target and when the target is hit.
The Florida Democrat added that al-Qaeda has terrorist goals that overlap in planning and execution and are carried out at a rate of about once every 12 to 18 months. David Wellner, NPR News, the Capitol.
A Palestinian blew himself up today on a crowded Jerusalem bus, killing 19 passengers, including an 11-year-old girl. The attack with a nail-studded bomb hurt more than 50 people, many of them high school students. The militant Hamas movement claimed responsibility for the bombing. Hours later, Israeli tanks rolled into the West Bank town of Jenin and the nearby Jenin refugee camp. Israeli troops also shot and killed a Palestinian at a West Bank roadblock. The army said the man was on its wanted list. Another bad day for Colorado firefighters as 9 fires in the state test the limits of their abilities. The Hayman fire near Denver continues to burn out of control, and another in the southwest corner of the state is forcing more evacuations. Aaron Schachter reports.
The Hayman blaze has raced over fire lines and made significant runs, confounding firefighters. More residents are on alert to leave their homes. Fire Information Officer Connie Power says Mother Nature is not playing nice. Tuesday was declared another red flag day.
We reached humidity of only 4% with temperatures in the 85 and 90 degree range and gusts to 30 miles an hour. And we expect this condition to persist for 2 or 3 more days, at least.
Just outside Durango, the Missionary Ridge fire continues to spread despite a growing number of firefighters tackling the blaze. It's now estimated at over 37,000 acres. About 4,000 people have been driven from their homes. For NPR News, I'm Aaron Schachter in Denver.
In stocks today, the Dow Industrials gained 18 points to close at 9,706. The NASDAQ Composite Index lost 10 points. It closed at 1,542. This is NPR News. Federal safety officials have grounded 5 air tanker planes used for firefighting following yesterday's crash of a similar tanker in California. The C-130A lost its wings and crashed while fighting a fire near Yosemite National Park. All 3 people aboard were killed. The C-130As are used to spray flame retardant on wildfires. The National Interagency Fire Center, based in Boise, Idaho, has 5 of the planes under contract from a civilian company. Federal officials want to see if the crash was caused by a fault that could be present in similar airplanes. Minnesota's third-party governor, Jesse Ventura, says he will not seek re-election. Perry Finelli reports from Minnesota Public Radio.
Ventura, an independent, was expected to announce whether he'd seek a second term this week, but he surprised a Minnesota Public Radio audience during a live interview when he said he was using the program to make his political intentions known.
I will not run again. And it's official. I'm doing it right here on your show right now.
The 50-year-old Ventura says his heart is no longer in the job, and he's tired of what he calls media attacks on his family. The former professional wrestler was elected in 1998, saying at the time that his campaign had shocked the world. Ventura says he plans to return to the private sector when his term ends in November, although he refused to say what kind of work he'll pursue. For NPR News, I'm Perry Finelli in St. Paul.
For a second day in a row, bad weather is preventing the landing of the space shuttle Endeavour. NASA officials said clouds and rain prevented the shuttle from landing at Cape Kennedy, Florida, while a backup landing site in California was too windy. Forecasters say the weather for both locations looks better tomorrow. Corey Flintoff, NPR News, Washington.
Support for NPR comes from the George Gund Foundation and Rockefeller Brothers Fund, providing support for NPR cultural programming through a Charles E. Culpepper Endowment Grant.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Even if you're squeamish at the sight of blood, I think you'll find it fascinating to hear the story of blood, including the misconceptions that doctors had before modern medicine. My guest, Douglas Starr, is the author of Blood, An Epic History of Medicine and Commerce. The book is the basis of the new TV series, Red Gold, The Epic Story of Blood, which begins Sunday night on most public television stations. In conjunction with the series, a new paperback edition of Starr's book has just been published with a post-September 11th afterword. Starr is the co-director of the Knight Center for Science and Medical Journalism at Boston University. I asked him about some of the early beliefs surrounding blood before anyone understood its chemical makeup.
It's really interesting about blood because people have always felt so intensely about it, maybe because if you lose it, you die. But, you know, as you know, it's in all sorts of religious rituals. It's got national significance. People attach all sorts of values to it, as did doctors. From the ancient times, it was thought to be one of the four humors, and that if you were sick, maybe you needed to balance the humors by draining one of them, so they would drain blood in an effort to make people better. Later on, when physicians began to understand that maybe blood isn't something you just remove, they still couldn't get away from the mystical associations, so they adopted a philosophy called vitalism, which meant that maybe blood is a nutrient, maybe you don't just have to drain it to make somebody healthy, but it still carries the characteristics of the creature in which it flows. So the blood of a lion was thought to be brave, and the blood of a sheep was thought to be meek, and so on.
When you say that blood was one of the four humors, what were the other three?
Let's see, it was choler, phlegm, bile, and blood. And that was the Greek system in which the humors of the body were thought to mirror the elements of the universe that kept everything in balance. But I should say that bloodletting began even before the Greeks. There's hieroglyphic evidence that the Egyptians did bloodletting as well. It's just something people always did. Oddly, there was never any evidence that it did any good.
Before we get to bloodletting, what is in blood?
Blood, that's a good question. Blood consists
of several... I didn't expect a laugh out of that line.
No, well, it's funny. You know, nobody's asked that before. I'm sorry. Nobody's actually asked that. Blood is a fascinating liquid. There's red cells, those little red cells that carry hemoglobin, which is the molecule that carries oxygen. There's plasma, and that's that sort of amber-colored, clear liquid. And if you let a pint of blood sit for a long time, the red cells settle to the bottom, and then the plasma is like the top 60%. And that's a protein solution with antibodies and other proteins and water and salts. And then in between is this little buffy coat, and that has platelets. And those are very sensitive bodies that aid in clotting, and there's also white cells in that section as well.
Here comes another laugh line, just so we have the basics.
Sorry.
What are the actual functions that blood serves in the body?
Okay. First of all, blood carries oxygen and nutrients to all of the organs and all of the cells. That's probably the most important things it does. It keeps our tissue alive. And the other thing it does is carry immune agents and antibodies to fight disease. The other thing it does that a lot of people don't think about is it's a hydrostatic fluid. And that is, if you keep enough blood and plasma in the veins and arteries, it keeps them full so that fluids could move around. And one of the things that happened, interestingly enough, they discovered in World War I, is when people started running out of blood, they would die from shock, not so much because they lost the red cells and the oxygen, but just when you didn't have enough this pressure in the vessels, they collapsed and it kind of cut off the circulation to your organs.
Okay, well, let's get to bloodletting now. I mean, for centuries, one of the curative things was believed to be draining the person of a lot of blood, which goes so against everything that we know now. Why was that believed to be curative?
Nobody really knows how it started. Some people theorize that seeing women in menstrual cycles perhaps thought they were relieved by bleeding, but nobody really knows how it got started. But it did get started, and people did it for about 2,500 years.
That's a very long time.
It's a very long time, especially when there was really never any evidence that it did any good. And one of the interesting things about doctors before the 19th century is they didn't really keep records. In the early part of the 19th century, they kept billing records, but they never kept records saying, we tried this on this patient and this was the result. So they were very anecdotal about it, and they always interpreted whatever happened to their benefit. So if they let someone's blood out and miraculously they got better despite the doctor's efforts, they would say, well, it cured them. If they let blood out until the person died, they say, it's a shame that they died because we almost cured them.
So was there like a science to bloodletting? Like if you had one disease, would they take a pint of blood and another disease, two pints of blood? One disease and incisions for another?
They were absolutely fetishistic about the exactitude of bloodletting. And it's interesting, there was a Greek school of bloodletting, which say if you were bleeding from your left nostril, they would bleed from your left elbow to stop it somehow.
Mm-hmm.
But then when the Roman and Greek empires fell and sort of the seed of learning went to the Arabic world, they sort of felt the opposite. They called it revulsive bloodletting. So if you were bleeding from your left nostril, in order to stop that, they bleed you from your right elbow. There were all sorts of calendars and charts and specificity about how to bleed in case of this or this, when to use leashes, when to use a lancet. They had all sorts of wonderful, zany devices. One was called a schnapper, and then it was created by a Viennese inventor, and it was actually a bunch of little blades. And if you lacked the skill to slice with a lancet, you'd put this box against the person's arm, sort of pull back the trigger, and snap it, and the blade would slice diagonally across the vein. So it was quite a science.
And you know, I know the word the lancet, and I know there's a medical journal called the Lancet, but I've never really seen a lancet. How is that used?
A lancet is an exquisite little blade sharpened on two edges, and it was the French loved it. And it was very small, and with a very deft flick of the fingers, a skilled bloodletter could sort of slice up along a vein. Now, you didn't want to slice across it because you'd sever it. And it took quite a bit of skill. Then they'd bleed them into exquisitely wrought bleeding bowls, many of which were made in Venice and became family heirlooms. Sometimes they would do cupping, in which they would warm a bowl and put it against your skin, and the warmth would draw a blister, and then they'd flick that and bleed it. As I say, it was quite a science. It's too bad it didn't do any good.
You know, I just find it amazing to think of how that was made a science for so long, and all it did was hurt people and not help them.
Yeah, and it's very interesting. One of the reasons bloodletting faded in the 19th century was there was a series of typhus epidemics in Britain. And a lot of the fevers that affect people, like malaria, are excitatory fevers. So if you bleed someone to the point of fainting, and they've been raving in their delirium before that, you might think the person's getting better. But typhus is a debilitating fever, and the bleeding only appeared to make them worse. And that was one of the several elements that made people realize maybe this isn't the best idea.
What else made them realize that bleeding wasn't the best idea?
Well, there came the birth of bacteriological science, in which people began to understand that there was such a thing as called germs, people like Pasteur and Ehrlich. There was the germ theory of disease. That was in the 19th century. And there was a French doctor named Pierre-Charles Alexandre Louis who started doing that. He would sort of wander the hospital corridors of Paris, actually talking to patients and writing down what they said. And at the end of many of these studies, he would tabulate what worked and what didn't. And he conclusively showed that removing blood had no relation to curing people.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Douglas Starr. He's the author of the book Blood, An Epic History of Medicine and Commerce. And this book is the basis of a new PBS series called Red Gold, The Epic Story of Blood, which begins on most PBS stations this Sunday. Let's look at the first blood transfusion, which you write about in your book. And this was between a calf and a mentally ill man. When did this happen?
This was 1667. And there were other experimental transfusions, but this was the first real one in which I was able to get complete records. You could still find the laboratory notes. And it was actually done for psychotherapy.
So how are these two paired, the calf and the mentally ill man?
Do you mean physically? How did they connect
No, why? Why were they? Why a calf? Why a blood transfusion in the first place? Why a calf?
Right. This was wonderful. And one of the things I did in the book, I should say, there's a very sharp difference between fiction and nonfiction. And when I was getting into the topic, so many of these stories astounded me and seemed unbelievable on the face of it that I made a personal rule to go back to primary sources for everything and that every sentence would be literally true. Because, as you know from our discussion, a lot of these things are difficult to believe. So what I'm telling you is literally true. But this was a period of time when people weren't sure what was going on with blood. It was in the 1600s. William Harvey had discovered there was such a thing as circulation. They realized now there were blood vessels, and blood moves sort of around in a circle through the body. And people began experimenting, well, if it does, maybe we could put something into the circulatory system and have an effect. And they began injecting milk into animals and liquor to see how they behaved. And then they started putting the blood from one animal into another to see if it could resuscitate them. So this was kind of scientific. But at the same time, these people believed in this theory of vitalism, this sort of mystical belief that the blood carried the characteristics of the creature in which it flowed. So there was a physician in the court of Louis XIV, Jean-Baptiste Denis, and he was doing some experiments with calves and dogs, and he put some ram's blood into a horse, and he thought maybe this could be a good thing for people. And he didn't want to put blood from one person into another because he thought the blood of people was too debauched by drinking and people's lifestyles. And he thought the blood of animals would be more innocent. So there came the night when a nobleman brought in a madman. His name was Antoine Moroy, and he was known in the neighborhood. He would have frenzies in which he would strip naked and run through the neighborhood setting house fires. So he brought him into Denise's lab, and he said, maybe you could help him. And Denise figured maybe transfusing some blood from the calf into this madman would transfer some of the calf's gentleness and it might calm him down.
What did happen?
Well, it did calm him down because it almost killed him. You can't put animal blood into a person. Your allergic system goes wild. You know, the antibodies attack the cells. The broken bits of cells hurt your kidneys. So he injected some blood into the man. He tied him down, tied a calf down, created some kind of cannula connecting the two. We put in a small quantity. It's hard to say how much. And the man immediately had an allergic reaction in which the heat began rising up his arm and he became very weak and feverish, which the doctor interpreted as progress because he did seem to calm down. So a couple of days later, he tries it again. And this time, as in any reaction, the man has a severe antibody allergic reaction, which not only does he have the heat rising up his arm, he's urinating black, which we now know is broken red cells. He's vomiting. He has a severe fever. And then he really becomes quite mild. And for all eyes of the late 17th century, the man is cured.
Did he survive his cure?
Well, gets a little complicated. So Moroy goes home. Now, meanwhile, I should say the English who had been working on this technique were absolutely outraged. They felt he stole the idea from them. He didn't. He gave them credit. So they got their own madman, and they transfused him. And he, after almost dying, appeared briefly to calm down. Meanwhile, the noblemen of the French court, who specialized in all sorts of intrigues, started attacking Dr. Denis as using, one of them called it a technology from Satan's boutique. One of them said something very interesting. He said, there's no way that this could work. On the other hand, if it does work, there are not enough animals on the planet Earth to satisfy the demand for this kind of thing. So meanwhile, the madman's wife takes him home, and everything's fine. But then a couple of weeks later, she knocks at her door with her husband in tow and says he's having frenzies again. Could the doctor transfuse him? And the doctor looks at the man, who's really in bad shape, and declines. Sometime later, the wife gets in league with some of the doctor's enemies and says, I'll slander you. I'll make it public that you're killing my husband if you don't transfuse him. So he tries to transfuse the patient again, but the patient dies before he can actually get any blood into him.
So was the animal killed whose blood was being used for the transfusion?
There's no record of what came of the animal,
right.
so I can't put that disclaimer on saying, you know, there are no animals harmed in the course of this experiment.
So eventually the doctors figured out that this type of transfusion from animal to human was going to kill the human and not cure them.
Well, it happened rather quickly because after Mr. Moy died, the wife started slandering the doctor, saying the doctor killed my husband, when the doctor full well knew he didn't. And he actually brought a slander trial against the wife. And I was able to get the records of that trial, which are tantalizingly almost complete. And the records I found were able to say that partway through the trial, a new piece of evidence came out. Everybody was testifying for both sides. And then a piece of evidence came out that the wife, tired of the husband's brutality, had been slipping arsenic into his soup. And they found this out because one day he put a bowl of it on the floor and the family cat drank some and died. So the lieutenant of the court said, this court will now inquire into the murder of Mr. Moy by his wife. And unfortunately, the record ends there because there was a fire that destroyed all the records. That said, the court ruled the doctor innocent, but this created such a brouhaha that the technology was absolutely abandoned for the next 150 years.
What a story. My guest is science journalist Douglas Starr. He's the author of Blood, An Epic History of Medicine and Commerce. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is science journalist Douglas Starr. His book, Blood, is the basis of the new PBS series called Red Gold, The Epic Story of Blood. It begins Sunday night on most public television stations. You date the first modern blood transfusion in 1908. What made this the first modern transfusion?
Well, there had been some transfusions in the early 1800s, half the people would die. There was nothing, they didn't have sterile procedure. It was quite primitive. But in 1908, Dr. Alexis Carrel was working at the Rockefeller Institute in New York. And he was a famous surgeon from France who'd perfected a technique called anastomosis in which he could actually stitch a vein to an artery by hand, which it's almost incomprehensible to us. And he developed his skill in part by studying with a seamstress in Lyon, France. So he was experimenting with animals doing this. You know, it was sort of the forerunner to microsurgery. And one night, there's a knock at his door in the middle of the night. One of his colleagues' wife had given birth to a baby girl who was critically anemic and said, "Doctor, you must come to my house. I feel that the only thing can save her is your transfusion technique." And the doctor said, "You know, how can I do this? I've only experimented on animals. And he said, you must come. So he goes to the house, and there's the baby, absolutely white as a sheet, and there's the mother and the uncle and the father all looking distressed. So the doctor tries a radical technique. He puts the baby on, binds her to a board. I think it may have been an ironing board or the table, and he slices open the father's forearm, and this is without anesthetic, and he teases out an artery and stitches it to a vein in the baby's thigh, and only using his finger to regulate the pressure, he actually begins to refill the baby with her father's blood. Now, this was good technique. The only thing they lacked is they weren't doing blood types at the time, so it was just dumb luck that the baby and the father had the same type. And as the moments passed, the uncle left a diary of the affair. The baby actually began to refill with blood, and he could see her color change, and this line of pink started her thigh and then rose to her stomach and her chest and her shoulders. And he wrote that when the pink got to the top of her ear, he said, "Dr. Carroll, you better turn it off or she'll burst." And he closed the vein, stitched up the ear, and everybody survived fine. And that kind of initiated transfusion as a technique that people could begin to use.
Wow. So other doctors started borrowing this technique afterwards?
Others did it, and they used various devices to make mm-hmm. it a little more manageable. There was a George Washington Crile who developed a little ring that made it work, and this was called direct transfusion. And this continued well into the 1920s.
Direct transfusion being from one person's body directly to the other, not...
Right.
There's no blood bank.
No bottle.
There's no vial of blood. Right. No bag of blood.
Now, they did figure out blood types and did figure out preservatives, mm-hmm. so then you could pass briefly into a bottle and into the other person via a pump. They started to collect people, and this became known as donors on the hoof. So their version of the blood bank would be a bunch of people in the community. You could call them, and at a moment's notice, they'd come in and they'd submit to this rather difficult procedure.
So in order to have blood banks and procedures where it's not directly from one person's veins into another, they had to figure out what clotting was and how to overcome it temporarily.
Right, and that was Richard Lewison who figured out citrate, because they did all sorts of things. You know, they tried coating all the materials with paraffin and keeping it cold and keeping things moving and pumping quickly. But you know, a blood clot is a really powerful thing. So Richard Lewison figured out a certain solution of sodium citrate that kept it liquid. Now, interestingly, it still didn't occur to anybody to do this for long-term storage. And that's something that really the credit goes to the Soviets of the 1930s, who figured out that you could actually use cadaver blood in a blood bank, and those were the first real blood banks.
Douglas Starr is the author of Blood, An Epic History of Medicine and Commerce. It's the basis of a new PBS series called Red Gold. The series begins Sunday on most public TV stations. Starr is the co-director of the Knight Center for Science and Medical Journalism at Boston University. He'll be back in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Barnes & Noble Booksellers and the Discover Great New Writers Program, which features the literary voices of tomorrow today. Information available at Barnes & Noble stores and on the web at www.bn.com. And from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. And by DMZ Columbia Records and bluegrass musician Ralph Stanley, featuring his new self-titled album produced by T-Bone Burnett, available in stores. Information online at ralphstanley.net. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, World War II and blood, what the Nazis believed and why it backfired, and why American blood banks were segregated by race. We continue our conversation about blood with Douglas Starr. Also, TV critic David Bianculli recommends TV shows now collected on DVD. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with Douglas Starr, author of the book Blood, An Epic History of Medicine and Commerce. It's the basis of the new PBS series Red Gold, which begins Sunday night on most public TV stations. When we left off, we were talking about some of the innovations in blood science just before World War II. Now, you point out that a lot of this new knowledge about blood, clotting, transfusions came just in time for World War II, when a lot of blood was needed. Yeah. What are some of the breakthroughs that happened during World War II?
Some of the big things were spinning off the plasma, and this was something that was developed in this country, and they found that plasma had a very, very long shelf life, and at the time, blood just had a shelf life of a couple of weeks. It's now over a month, but the time was short. But plasma had a shelf life for months and months. Then they could freeze dry plasma, which kept it useful almost indefinitely. Edwin Cohn at Harvard then figured out that you could break plasma into smaller constituents like albumin and gamma globulins. So what you had now was blood wasn't just this one resource. It wasn't like crude oil anymore, but it was like cracking oil. You know, much as you had gasoline and oil and petrochemicals, now you had, you know, red cells and plasma and freeze-dried plasma and albumin. And there was a whole constellation of materials people could use.
Meanwhile, while we were understanding more about blood and perfecting its storage and usage, the Nazis had theories about blood and the purity of blood that they were using as justification for, genocide.
Yes, I mean, the Nazis really crippled themselves. In the years preceding World War II, one of the sad realities is that the medical profession embraced Nazism as fast or faster than any other profession. So they purged themselves of Jewish doctors, many of whom happened to be prominent people in hematology, and then they dismissed all the Allied advances in hematology as degenerate foreign practices, and they turned their attention to looking at blood types as proof of their own racial superiority. Now, it should be said that blood types don't mean anything in particular in terms of the way you behave or the way you act. It's like eye color or hair color. It just doesn't mean anything. But they got obsessed with this, and they assumed that the type A was the Aryan blood, and the type B was somehow Slavic or Semitic blood, and the tests that came out of Nazi Germany were just unbelievable. They did studies showing that type A Aryans were more inclined to be scholars and athletes. Type B were more inclined to be degenerates and shopkeepers. There was one study that actually alleged that people with type B blood sat on the toilet longer than type A blood. then they produced these magnificent color maps showing how the A blood types were about to swarm over Germany and creating an island of B blood. Now, what's wrong with this? Number one, it's completely invalid scientifically. Number two, it wasn't even valid statistically in Berlin. Berlin didn't even have a majority of A blood types. The other thing was, instead of doing, you know, what they should have done with blood, using it as a strategic resource as we did, and the British did, and the French did, they almost dismissed it. So they did mark a few of their soldiers as pure Aryan and tattoo them with their blood types to have donors on the hoof. But the other thing was, even in Nazi Germany, you didn't have that many pure Aryan people. So for all intents and purposes, they didn't have transfusion. I have intelligence reports from American doctors who stumbled upon German field hospitals and found them absolutely blood white and out of compassion would give them plasma. You know, they couldn't bear to see it. Nobody's actually done a calculation, but it must have made a difference of thousands and thousands of lives.
Well, meanwhile, in the United States, we had some of our own problems with this issue of blood. Blood in the United States during World War II was segregated between African American mm-hmm. and white.
Right.
Why?
Well, this is not a happy thing. It's interesting. One of the most famous people in the history of blood is Charles Drew, and he was the one who figured out how to process plasma in an industrial way so it didn't get infected. You know, milk, you think of milk as being handled in such a sterile way, mainly because it's a rich medium. Well, so's plasma. And they were having terrible problems getting plasma together in large quantities. One of the first things Drew did was help organize a blood bank in New York that was sending plasma to London during the Blitz. And yet, because Drew was an African American, he wasn't allowed to give blood to his own blood bank. Now, there were a couple of reasons for this beyond just lumpen bigotry. One was that this whole blood bank thing was pretty new, and it had never really been organized by the military before. And the military, wrongly we now know, was thinking people are so nervous about this, you know, if we mix the races, that'll just put it over the top. And they also figure, you know, what if some kid from the South is bleeding to death on the battlefield and refuses to take, you know, quote, colored blood? You know, if they had just thought for 2 minutes longer, they would have thought, I don't think he's going to ask whether the blood is white or colored if he's bleeding to death. But they did have this prohibition, and the American Red Cross and others spoke out against it, and then they eased the prohibition, saying that African Americans could give blood, but that it would be separately labeled.
When did this practice end?
This continued in some place into the civil rights period of the 60s. It ended fairly quickly in the North. In fact, during or after World War II, a lot of places ended it. And I should say that a lot of Red Cross people in the blood banks themselves just said, we're not going to listen to this. But they did separate it in the South until the civil rights period, and now, of course, it doesn't happen anymore.
My guest is science journalist Douglas Starr. He's the author of Blood, An Epic History of Medicine and Commerce. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is Douglas Starr, and he's the author of the book Blood, An Epic History of Medicine and Commerce. This book is the basis for a new PBS series called Red Gold on the history of blood, history of our knowledge of blood. And this series begins on most public television stations this Sunday. Once some scientists understand how blood can be used for transfusions and how blood can be stored and preserved before transfusion, then you have blood banks developing, and then you have more of a commerce in blood developing as well. You write a little bit about the competition between the American Association of Blood Banks and the American Red Cross. You say this competition balkanized America into a jumble of territories with incompatible rules. What were some of the problems?
Well, this was something that began in World War II. There were already some blood banks and hospitals in this country, and the military needed a national body to coordinate blood collection, so they appointed a disaster agency, the Red Cross. After World War II, people kind of let it go. They didn't see the value of this. But then certain visionaries like Leslie Groves, who helped direct the Manhattan Project, and Edwin Cohn of the Blood World said, you know, if there's ever a nuclear attack, we're going to really need a lot of blood. So they revived the program. And it should be said that some of the chief people in the Red Cross saw this as a good way to raise funds, not so much for selling the substance, but that this would be a good way to keep the Red Cross in people's minds in between disasters. So they started spreading blood banks around the country, and a lot of local associations said, you know, you're poaching on our territory. And this became very confusing for the public. The Red Cross had rules saying, look, everybody could get blood, you know, regardless of whether they've given or not. Some blood banks had rules say if you're going to get 4 pints in a hospital, you should recruit your friends to give 4 pints. And it became very acrimonious and confusing for many years. The American Association of Blood Banks is actually a trade association of blood banks, and it should be said that the Red Cross now belongs to that association. But even now, we still have a fairly competitive situation among the various groups.
Are the various groups a mix of commercial and nonprofit companies?
Well, blood now is broken into two industries. If you go to the hospital and you get red cells or plasma, that's completely nonprofit. Somebody gave that, you know, just by going and donating it, and it's put in the blood bank, and people aren't making big profits from that. It goes to the hospital. I mean, it's expensive. Red cells are $180 a unit. But this is considered the nonprofit world. Now, plasma is different. You may remember that we were talking about Edwin Cohn before World War II figuring out that plasma can be made into different products. That became the realm of the commercial pharmaceutical industry. plasma became made into factor VIII, which is helps the blood of hemophiliacs to clot. Gamma globulins, something like rabies vaccine is made from plasma, about 20 products in all. And that is a for-profit industry, and it's run by multinational corporations, and it spans the globe. And if you donate your plasma to a center, you're paid for doing that generally.
Because there's going to be a profit made on it.
There's a profit made, and it's a long and tiresome procedure. You know, they use something called plasmapheresis, in which the machine takes out your blood but then returns the red cells and keeps the plasma. And in that way, you don't get anemic. And in that way, rather than giving, you know, a few times a year, I think it's six, you could give 100 times a year without danger of your health. It's just a different industry.
There was quite a scare about our blood bank system after the start of the AIDS epidemic, before the blood was tested for the presence of HIV. How safe would you say the blood system is now?
The blood system then was, people had a right to be scared. The blood system now is incredibly safe. The chance of HIV or hepatitis C in a unit of blood is one in a million or less. That's because it's so difficult to give blood now. I mean, you've got to submit to about 33 questions that are designed to see whether you're a member of a risk group. One of the questions is something like, if you're a female and if you've ever had sex with a man who's ever had sex with another man since 1977, you can't give. I mean, even interpreting that question is a job. So you answer all those questions, and then there are 8 or 9 tests, some of which detect the nucleic acid of any virus that might be in the blood. So it's incredibly safe. Not so in the third world, but in this country, in fact, the danger that we face at the moment is not so much the safety of the individual unit, but a lack of supply that could affect people's health.
My guest is Douglas Starr. He's the author of the book Blood, An Epic History of Medicine and Commerce. And that book is the basis of the new PBS series, Red Gold, The Epic Story of Blood. And that series starts on most PBS stations this Sunday. Since one of the issues you're really examining is blood and global commerce, I'm wondering if there's any equivalent to, say, fruit and vegetables. In other words, we have certain standards in the United States for pesticides. Certain pesticides you can't use because they're considered too toxic. But there are other countries, certain South American countries, for instance, that use these more toxic pesticides. And when we buy fruits and vegetables, we might be eating imported ones that use the more toxic pesticides. Is there a similar issue with blood, where there are different standards in different countries for protecting the blood supply, and where, you know, in different parts of the world, the blood isn't as safe as it is here?
Yeah, it's similar to what you described with fruit, but reverse. We are the OPEC of blood products. Our blood now is amazingly safe. What we do, and we don't export any, nor do we really import much anymore. I'll get to that in a minute. But traditionally, blood is not imported or exported, but the plasma products travel the globe. And because the U.S. has always had flexible regulations about plasma collection, we've always had a surplus that we've exported around the world. So as I say, we were the OPEC of plasma. There was a period in the 70s that I refer to as the wildcat days in the book, where even we started to run short of a way to fill the demand. So we started importing from Central American companies. Now, those were very clean. They were actually FDA inspected, but there were terrible political problems with that. And in fact, it was a plasma center in Nicaragua and the outrage that it fostered that led to the Nicaraguan Revolution. In terms of varying standards, what you tend to find is the first world countries have very high standards and generally very safe blood supplies. And it's really iffy in third world countries. You've got countries that don't have the reagents to test. A WHO team went to Kenya and found that, you know, at least 45% of the people had no access to safe blood. In 2 weeks there, they couldn't even find an HIV test kit. Or you may find a blood bank that could test for AIDS on Fridays, and the rest of the days it's a crapshoot. So the real disequilibrium in the world now is the fairly safe stuff in the first world and the really questionable stuff in developing countries.
Right. You're the co-director of the Knight Center for Science and Medical Journalism at Boston University. And I'm wondering, as a science and medical journalist, if you think there are certain issues now facing your part of journalism, certain issues unique to science and medical journalism right now?
I think the issues that face us as medical and health journalists are kind of looking at the systemic problems we might face as a nation, how to make the stories of national health care systems interesting. Science is not as open as it used to be. This is a problem we're facing in our profession. It used to be that if somebody came out with a piece of science in the pharmaceutical industry or in universities or in medicine, this was open. This was in the open literature. But the influence of money and power and the newly relaxed patent laws are making it more possible for private corporations to privatize science. And this is a terribly dangerous thing. In the way that some companies are trying to privatize parts of the genome, there was a recent incident in which a company only published a piece of its findings in Science magazine and said, well, the rest is bought and paid for. I mean, this is simply not science anymore. Science has to be open and available so people could replicate results and so journalists can ask about it. That's a big issue. We're finding that certain sectors of the healthcare industry are getting more closed than they used to, so we are having a real challenge with the pharmaceutical industry. Now, they have their own priorities in that they're working on something and they've invested a huge amount of money on it and it's proprietary, and they only want to announce what they want to announce when they want to announce it. Oftentimes, those announcements are geared to stock options as opposed to scientific advances. And it's very difficult, although we willingly accept it as part of our job, it's very difficult for health policy journalists to say, okay, what's really going on here? How important are these trials really? How important is this new drug really? How important is this biotech development really? So it's getting a lot more sophisticated than it used to be. You know, at the same time, news holes are getting smaller and some people are asking that the information be dumbed down. So this is the tightrope we're walking. I should say it makes this a very interesting time and a very exciting time to be a journalist in this field.
Well, Douglas Starr, thank you so much for talking with us.
It was a pleasure, Terry.
Douglas Starr is the author of Blood, An Epic History of Medicine and Commerce. It's the basis of a new PBS series called Red Gold. The series begins Sunday on most public TV stations. Starr is the co-director of the Knight Center for Science and Medical Journalism at Boston University. Here's a passage from Philip Glass's Dracula. Glass wrote this score to accompany screenings of the Bela Lugosi film. Coming up, TV critic David Bianculli has some DVD alternatives to summer reruns. This is Fresh Air. TV critic David Bianculli has been watching a lot of TV this summer, but very little of it new. The rest comes from another source he loves.
If you want to watch TV right now, about the best thing you can do is watch sporting events. The U.S. making an unprecedented run in the World Cup, Tiger Woods winning another major, Shaq and the L.A. Lakers winning another championship. And in the sports of fame-seeking and national embarrassment, there's always American Idol, which has grabbed an instant sizable audience on Fox. Most of television, though, is in reruns. Even on cable, Sex and the City won't start again until next month, and The Sopranos doesn't show up until September. But I found something to watch. Something not only to while away the time, but to consume it endlessly and giddily. And the irony is, I've avoided the boredom of watching old TV shows by watching old TV shows. These shows, however, are on DVD. There are no commercials, and I can watch them when and how often I want. They come packaged beautifully and massively, a complete season at a time. Most of them are loaded with extras, from deleted scenes to commentary from producers and actors. They look great, they sound great, and there's simply no better way to enjoy your favorite TV show. I've raved before about the DVD format in general, but this time I'm getting specific. It's clear this new technological format is getting very sophisticated very quickly, so it's time to keep track of some of the best new DVD releases as they come out. Some of these compilations are of TV series still on the air. Friends, which formerly was out in a pair of best-of packages, has recently been released with its entire first season in one big box set. Another recent release is the complete third season of Sex and the City, which basically catches us up to date on that steadily maturing HBO comedy. There aren't many extras here, but there don't have to be. The episodes are terrific and habit-forming. Slip in the first disc, and I'll bet you can't watch just one. They're also packaged very sexily, in a see-through plastic case, and look great on your video shelf while taking up less space in the process. In terms of attractive packaging, though, almost no one beats the folks at 20th Century Fox. Having worked their way through the first 4 years of The X-Files, they've just released the complete fifth season in a gorgeous set covering six discs and tons of extras. Deleted scenes, alternate audio commentary, the works. And just last week, Fox released the complete second season, also on six discs, of Buffy the Vampire Slayer. Buffy is one of my all-time favorite TV shows, and to enjoy it like this isn't work. It's pure pleasure. There are plenty of brilliant episodes in the second season, some very playful, others amazingly dark and dramatic. And the shows are bursting with supporting characters who will pop up again in later seasons or meet untimely ends in this very collection. And series creator Joss Whedon even shows up this time, providing a very entertaining alternate audio commentary on Innocence, one of the best episodes in the entire Buffy canon.
I created Buffy the Vampire Slayer as a movie a long time ago to protect, as I've said before, the blonde girl in the alley who always got killed. One of the distinguishing features of the blonde girl in the alley who always got killed was that she actually had sex. She always seemed to be punished for it. That bothered me, and I thought it wasn't fair. So Buffy was created as a sort of stereotype buster on that level. However, when we came back to do the series, we knew we had to keep her in high school for a while. We had to bounce her age back to 15, make her a sophomore instead of a senior. So the issue of sex was one that we were going to have to deal with eventually in a different and somewhat more serious way on the series. Innocence represents the effort to do that. What we basically wanted to show was a horror movie version of the idea of I sleep with my boyfriend and now he doesn't call me, and also he's killing hookers in alleys.
For a Buffy fan, there is no greater experience and no better gift. But there's one other fresh DVD out there that I've loved just as much. A new BBC video release of The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy, the 1981 TV miniseries version of Douglas Adams' sci-fi radio comedy. This Hitchhiker set includes not only the complete miniseries, but enough extras to occupy an entire second disc. More than 20 years later, though, it's the pure wit of Hitchhikers that still delights the most. The special effects are tacky now, but not the ideas. One of the show's concepts was a universal translator that actually was nothing more than a particular species of fish stuck into one's ear. Here's how the computerized Hitchhiker's Guidebook, whose voice is provided by Peter Jones, describes that fish and its cosmic and religious implications.
The babelfish is small, yellow, leech-like, and probably the oddest thing in the universe. It feeds on brainwave energy, absorbing all unconscious frequencies and then excreting telepathically a matrix formed from the conscious frequencies and nerve signals picked up from the speech centers of the brain. The practical upshot of which is that if you stick one in your ear, you instantly understand anything said to you in any form of language. The speech you hear decodes the brainwave matrix. Now, it is such a bizarrely improbable coincidence that anything so mind-bogglingly useful could evolve purely by chance that many thinkers have chosen to see it as a final and clinching proof of the non-existence of God. The argument runs something like this. I refuse to prove that I exist, says God, for proof denies faith, and without faith I am nothing. But, says man, the babelfish is a dead giveaway, isn't it? It proves you exist, and so therefore you don't. QED. Oh dear, says God, I hadn't thought of that, and promptly vanishes in a puff of logic. Oh, that was easy, says man, and for an encore he goes on to prove that black is white and gets killed on the next zebra crossing. Most leading theologians claim that this argument is a load of dingo's kidneys. But this didn't stop Ulan Khalufin making a small fortune when he used it as the central theme for his best-selling book, Well, That About Wraps It Up for God.
Well, that about wraps it up for me, too. But only for now. Coming up on the DVD horizon later this summer, the second season of The Simpsons, the third season of The Sopranos, the complete run of my so-called life, and the best TV drama ever written expressly for television, Dennis Potter's The Singing Detective. With all this coming to a DVD player near you, who needs summer reruns?
David Bianculli is TV critic for the New York Daily News. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our senior producer this week is Roberta Sharrock. Our engineer is Audrey Bentham. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Naomi Person, Monique Nazareth, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Patty Leswing, Jessica Chu, and Lauren Krenzel. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and by Bantam Trade Paperbacks, a division of Random House, publisher of Fish, Blood, and Bone by Leslie Forbes, a tale of literary suspense. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, Matt Damon on his life and his movies. He's starring in the new film, The Bourne Identity. His other films include The Talented Mr. Ripley, Saving Private Ryan, and the Oscar-winning Good Will Hunting, which he co-wrote with his friend Ben Affleck. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.